Since I'm the guy who prepares class schedules for each term, I guess being scheduled at noontime is some sort of retribution. Okay, try to get you out here as close to on time as possible. Here's a Reader's Digest version of the modern history of interpretation for the Isaiah apocalypse. Three dates to keep in mind: 1895, 1963, and 2003. In 1895, the British scholar T.K. Shane described Isaiah 24 through 27 as a singular production, which at first repels but at length fascinates the student, has no heading, and claims no famous prophet of old time as its author. That it should be Isaiah's is philologically and psychologically impossible. Both language and ideas are opposed to such a hypothesis. Isaiah 24 through 27 belongs to a late and imitative literary period, says Shane, because of its literary dependence on other earlier and contemporary biblical literature, and because of its artificial style. Despite a disclaimer that we may be occasionally uncertain which is the original passage and which the copy, Shane always construes literary similarities between Isaiah 24 through 27 and other Old Testament literature in favor of the priority or independence of the non-Isaianic literature. The style of the passage is artificial, he says, because of the singularity of many phrases on the one hand, but also because of the frequency of word features such as paronomasia and rhyme on the other. In a footnote, he insists that the real Isaiah uses paronomasia, plays on words, with tact and naturalness, which means, of course, that he regards the use of these features in Isaiah 24 through 27 as tactless and unnatural. Isaiah 24 through 27 is to be set aside as non-Isaianic also because of its forms of representation, its images, as well as the grammatical structure of its language, its ideas, notably the resurrection, and its social and religious circumstances. The merism of people and priests in 24 verse 2 is routinely read as referring to a time after the monarchy has collapsed. Jump ahead to 1963. G.W. Anderson urged scholars to reconsider the Isaiah apocalypse because he saw in it a greater literary unity than had been granted previously by the mainstream of scholarship, although he acknowledged that its elements are blended in a somewhat unusual way. As it turned out, a new generation of students responded to his exhortation. Between 1963 and 1997, 10 doctoral dissertations have appeared. Several of these works have promised to apply a fresh approach to the text, but remain marked by a fundamental and, in my view, uncritical reliance on historical critical conclusions which have acquired canon-like authority. What does the more recent scholarly treatment of Isaiah 24 through 27 look like? In 2003, Philip Schmitz began his article on the grammar of resurrection in Isaiah 26:19 with this description of the terrain. The features that distinguish these four chapters from their surroundings are the absence of a plausible connection with the Neo-Assyrian period, distinctive vocabulary and syntax, themes and imagery generally associated with later periods in the history of Israel. What's different? As Kohelet was wont to mark, Havel Havelim, Havel Havelim, Hakol Havel, Ve'ein Kol Chadash Tachat Hashamish. Vanity of vanities, vanity of vanities, all is vanity, and there is nothing new under the sun. But things are not quite that dire. Some recent scholarship has taken fresher looks at the Isaiah apocalypse, using different approaches to familiar evidence and looking also at new forms of evidence, although there remains a reticence to contradict critical orthodoxy about the date and authorship. I want to take a look at three examples of issues whose treatment might offer, I think, new support for the reasonability of an 8th century BC Isaianic reading of this singular production. In a scholarly realm, I'm not sure we can ask for more than that. Now, a passing observation is in order vis-a-vis the designation Isaiah Apocalypse. Although the scarlet letter of what Paul Robbie calls the A word has been deeply impressed into the discussion of this text, it just isn't an apocalypse, that is. If nothing else, Semeia 14, the report of a working group under the leadership of John J. Collins, which included a new definition for the genre apocalypse or apocalyptic, pushed Isaiah 24 through 27 effectively out of the category. It just isn't otherworldly enough. Enough on that. First example. It's a linguistic and literary one and concerns the very first word in the passage, hine, and the connection of Isaiah 24 through 27 with its preceding context. Hine Yahweh bokeh ka'aretz uvolaka, ba'iva paneha hefitz yoshveha. Behold, Yahweh is about to lay waste to the earth and destroy it, and he will twist or distort its surface. He will scatter its inhabitants. Only a few studies of the use and meaning of hine have been published over the years, although all grammars include at least a brief treatment of its function and meaning. The articles or essays deal with subsets of the total number of occurrences in the Hebrew Bible. In 1958, a French article, very brief, 6 pages, treats the occurrences of hine, or hineni, hine plus the first singular common pronominal suffix, preceded or not, with the conjunction, so vehini or vehineni, hine plus the participle. Most such occurrences have to do with interventions of Yahweh, and there is some nuance of imminence, the idea that, behold, something is just about to happen. Labuschagne wrote an essay in 1973, and it has one main point, to demonstrate that the two particles, hein and hine, which are used together nearly 1,200 times in the Hebrew Bible, are more than once used as conjunctions. Good idea there. McCarthy, in 1980, offers a comprehensive explanation of the uses, but only of a single form, vehine. Moraoka, whom some of you may be acquainted with as the one who updated Paul Jouan's French Hebrew grammar, included it in his investigation of so-called emphatic words. More recently, the best grammars, though brief, are those by van der Merwe et al. And by Wolfgang Schneider, both of which deal with discourse functions of the particles. Waltke and O'Connor, it's interesting to note, tend to observe the operations of hine only from the perspective of whatever other grammatical syntactical phenomenon is being investigated, use of pronominal suffixes, use of participles, and so forth, rather than from the perspective of the role of hine as such. As a result, in a number of cases, hine just simply goes untranslated, but the word's there. However, tucked into their discussions is one important point, the role of hine to indicate logical connection. This is an important point when commentators such as Marvin Sweeney argue that, introduced by an initial hine, behold, Isaiah 24 through 27 is syntactically independent from the preceding material. Now, I have tried to take a look at unsuffixed hine or vehine with and without the participle. Whether in narrative or prophecy, hine plus the participle is always sentence initial, may or may not be verse initial, and most often a marker for direct discourse, usually the first word by a speaker, and it marks the utterance that follows with logical significance in respect to sequence or consequence. Vehine is mid-verse, usually, and mid-sentence, always, and also shows logical connection with the preceding action or condition. It can point to a first item, event or utterance or thought or scene in a dream, but it also can point to a next such item, and in either event includes a call to perception, which might be optical, the behold translation, but also can be rational or intellectual. In this respect, hine operates something like our contemporary colloquialism, you know, or you see. By the use of hine, a speaker or writer seems to be making a linguistic effort to make sure that his hearers or readers are tracking with him. In the book of Isaiah, the pattern hine plus the participle occurs 14 times, 12 of which occur in so-called first Isaiah, and I won't rehearse the references. This seems to contradict, to no small degree, the argument on the basis of style that Isaiah 24 through 27 belongs to a later period. In some of the cases, the syntactic connection is reinforced by the inclusion of another particle, such as key in 3:1 and 26:21, or lakein, chapter 8, verse 7, but the other cases follow the simple pattern, hine, plus the subject, plus the participle. In 3:1, for example, the reason why Judah is enjoined to stop regarding man, chapter 2, verse 22, is because, you see, Yahweh, God of hosts, is taking away, or is about to take away, all of the human leadership on which the society depends. The announcement in 10:33 that, behold, the Lord will lop the boughs with terrifying power, restates and amplifies the preceding material about how God will turn against and defeat Assyria in order to rescue the remnant. Now, it is interesting to note that the English translations that I just gave there are from the ESV. And it's interesting to notice how the tenses vary given the same Hebrew construction. So there is a clear indication of the role and interpretation of what Dr. Vels calls levels of signifiers in his hermeneutics text. On level one, marks on the page, the same Hebrew constructions occur. But the relationships of events signified, level two signifiers, are read differently, including, and perhaps especially, on level three in the effort to associate the text with an external author's world. At any rate, the use of Hine to launch the announcement in 24:1 that Yahweh will empty the earth and lay it waste shows that this new material is predicated on the preceding material, the oracles against the nations in chapters 13 through 23. The logic which Hine directs us to understand, I think, and the reading strategy that it directs us to employ, and these directions are illocutionary, is that Isaiah 24:1 opens a section which expounds the overall message of the individual oracles in 13 through 23. These individual oracles constitute the data which the prophet interprets into another, larger framework that acknowledges Yahweh as the ruler over every order in creation. Another of the major issues in the scholarly study of the so-called apocalypse has been its internal structure. Form-critical approaches and conclusions have provided the foundations even for studies that aim to offer more integrative or holistic readings of the text. Interpretation of the whole is performed only after and in terms of interpretation of the parts. Consequently, interpretation of the parts in terms of the interpretation of the whole is skewed and even obscured. Two recent works that take new looks at how to identify the structure of Isaiah 24 through 27 are a volume in the Oude Testamentische Studien series by the Dutch Isaiah Workshop, a collection of essays on Isaiah 24 through 27 with an assortment of approaches, published in 2000, and a more recent book in 2006 by Stefan Nitsche, which proposes that Isaiah 24 through 27 is ein dramatischer Text, basically like a play script. A shared technique in both volumes is the investigation of the textual layouts of Hebrew manuscripts, especially the Great Isaiah Scroll from Qumran. The proposal is that textual layout, including the marking of Pentecost and Setumot, whether by lines and spaces or by Masoretic pe and samek, is a component of meaning. A setuma, according to Jenner in the Dutch book, draws attention to a special aspect in the line of thought and consequently adds a nuance to the subject matter, while on the other hand a petuka adds a new and sometimes unexpected argument to the line of thought or theme. I need to acknowledge that some of the pericopal divisions identified by form-critical approaches are supported by the text graphics of the Hebrew manuscripts, especially the significant divisions. However, the form-critical approaches consistently propose divisions which are not suggested by any manuscript tradition, but rather by debatable identifications of seams. The text graphics of the manuscripts are indicative of a reading tradition or traditions, which ought not be ignored. Nietzsche's work offers an additional important opportunity when he argues that the point of reference, the Bezugspunkt for Isaiah 24 through 27, is not the historical situation of the recipients or of the emergence of the various text pieces, but rather the point of view established by the text, which he acknowledges is the Buchzeit, that is, the time of the textual world, which is the perspective of Isaiah, son of Amoz. Nietzsche, of course, does not concede the question of Isaianic authorship to the historical Isaiah. Isaiah 24 through 27, though set in Isaianic times, according to him, cannot be a product of Isaiah. Those who would hope to hold on to Isaianic authorship, he says, confuse the prophet who appears in the literary work and his time with the author and his circumstance. He insists on a distinction between Buchgegenwart and Entstehungs- or Autorgegenwart, between the book present and the emergence or the author's present. But if the structure of the text, here's my comment now, if the structure of the text is organized in the form of a drama, play script, as he insists, or even as a speech, a prophetic speech, oh, think of that, then it contradicts the widespread view of a complex redaction history for Isaiah 24 through 27 and raises the issue of when questions of external referentiality are to be posed in relation to parts and wholes of texts. The third sample issue focuses on the matter of ideas, specifically the concept of resurrection. Shane had articulated his objections this way: the promise of the abolition of death and the hope of the resurrection of individual Israelites go beyond the exilic conceptions and become the more intelligible the later we place this composition in the Persian period. His position is informed by two underlying principles. One is that articulation of a doctrine in a biblical text represents always a mature understanding of that doctrine. The passages in view here, Isaiah 25:8 and 26:19, especially part A, are to be read as expressions of a fully formed doctrine of a general bodily resurrection of the dead at the last day. The second concomitant principle is one that sees the development of ideas, including doctrine, as a compressed phenomenon. The time from emergence to maturity is relatively short. The reading of doctrine in the Bible takes place in two planes, one canonical, the other historical. In a canonical reading, there is no development of doctrine. The biblical evidence is read in the aggregate and atemporally. But in a historical reading, which by its very nature takes time into account, there is development in the reception of doctrine. An important contribution to this issue comes from Jewish scholar John Levinson's Resurrection and the Restoration of Israel, published in Yale University Press last year. Levinson's overall argument is that the resurrection of the dead did not appear as a jarring innovation in Second Temple Judaism, but instead developed slowly and unevenly over the preceding centuries. He writes, "We face, in sum, a more complicated situation than scholars of the Hebrew Bible have usually taken to be the case. Death is universal in the Hebrew Bible and seldom reversed, but God promises, offers, and prefers life and saves his chosen people from annihilation. He even saves some individuals from a death that is impending or one that has already occurred. My point is not that a full-fledged doctrine of the resurrection of the dead, when it arrives, changes nothing. It changes much. But it also reflects certain key features of the deep structure of the theology of pre-exilic Israel. For this is a theology in which the fact of death and the promise of life, each of them of capital importance, stand in a relationship of tension. That tension will contribute to the full-fledged expectation of resurrection when it appears." Levinson reads Isaiah 24 through 27, especially 25:8 and 26:13 through 21, as an intertextual backdrop to Daniel 12:1 through 3. The Setumah paragraph from 26:12 through 19 explicates the raised hand of Yahweh in 26:11. Levinson refers to the doubleness of judgment, for example, the two ways of Psalm 1, as ubiquitous in biblical literature of various periods and genres. The dead ones, Matim, who have served other masters, cannot live or live again, 26, 13, and 14, but your dead ones, Meteka, will live, 26, 19, that is, Yahweh's faithful dead. Levinson acknowledges that the entailments of resurrection, especially its objects, develop through time. The standard critical proposal is for resurrection of the nation, but that incorrectly restricts the referent or referents of Israel. Levinson's work is careful. He declares the limits of what can be said, with a historically sensitive exegesis, about resurrection, as the theological reflection or reception of the Hebrew Bible unfolds. And yet he regards the plain sense of Isaiah 26:19 as, at a minimum, markedly less metaphorical than the dry bones of Ezekiel 37. Maximally, he writes, we may conclude that the verse in Isaiah envisions a resurrection of the dead quite close to that predicted in Daniel 12. Levinson offers a trenchant observation how modernistic readings of the biblical literature butt up against a key difference between ancient and modern perceptions of the basic categories of life and death. He writes, our modern conception of death as totally discontinuous with life impels us to understand the biblical community's pre-exilic condition as one of grave affliction and debility only, and thus to interpret the unmistakable language of resurrection as thoroughly metaphorical. If so, it is still a metaphor founded on the conviction that the literal referent is, however miraculous, indeed possible in the hands of God. What could have generated that conviction? Perhaps it stemmed from traditional affirmations of the Lord's unlimited power, which precisely because it is unlimited, extends to death as well as to life. Why, after all, should Almighty God be able to heal all illnesses but death? Well, thus far another look at Isaiah's apocalypse. As Nitsch acknowledged the Buchzeit for Isaiah 24 through 27 to be the perspective of Isaiah, son of Amoz, so the reading of the whole book of Isaiah is to be governed by its superscription, whether or not one regards it as original, like the key and time signatures in a musical composition. We might think that we can identify external reference, but our identifications always are under the influence of our vantage point on the text, and the Babylonian period always seems larger than the Assyrian period because we're closer to it. If the reading strategy of the book itself is established by its superscription and its major themes or theses by its opening statements, then to be congenial, implied readers, we have to give that reading a chance first.